Mercury retrograde says live from the ancient future, from the ancestral spirit world, and from the capital of capital, Washington, D.C. This is a metaphysical news service. This is the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm Caroline Casey, your weaver of context. So briefly, to weave a little bit of context into which I will make a nest for our intriguing guest, there are two strategical social change times this century as described by the planetary patterns. And the first time was 64 to 69, and the second time is right now. And it's a description of where we want new reinvented mythologies that speak to all of us. It's described as a kairos moment, a fulcrum moment, where everything that everyone does really matters. So that reminds us of our theme for this show, that we are always voting for reality, and it is always better to create prophecy than live predictions. So into this context, let me introduce our guest, an Aries, therefore a cultural agent provocateur, freed from the illusion of picking one thing and doing it forever. He is the former director of the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich, Jungian analyst. He's written a gazillion provocative, complex books that are in the libraries of most of the mythologically, psychically literate people I know. Before this most recent book, his book was written with Michael Ventura. We've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's getting worse. His forthcoming book, The Soul's Code, is completely delicious and completely appropriate to what we want to dive into about emerging cosmologies that speak to us. We welcome our first guest consciousness artist, James Hillman. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. That was a grand intro. Go, go, go.
Right. Or as your book actually says, let's get down.
Yeah, let's get down.
Let's get
right.
down. Let's get down to get up. There are many, many tasty things in your book. I found it also, having been a great fan of yours for many years, but this is a book in which you maintain your brilliance, but it's also completely tastily accessible. I mean,
it's aimed to be that way.
Right.
It's full of gossip.
Yes.
Stories, anecdotes. The method is anecdotal. Tell people's life stories. I don't mean case histories now. I mean life stories, especially stories of extraordinary people.
And especially, I thought one of the tastiest chapters actually was your chapter on growing down, mm-hmm. that we have this ridiculous fixation on growing up. And in that chapter, you talk about Josephine Baker, who's a completely interesting person. Do you want to tell a little more about Josephine Baker?
Well, Josephine Baker, you know, was born in this outcast hospital in East St. Louis. I mean, right at the bottom of everything for prostitutes, people with social diseases and all that. Her name was changed. She was kept naked by people who, when she was a little girl, she had the most horrible beginning of life. But already then, there was this magic in her. And it's that fact that you have some calling, some innate image that's already there, and it just unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. I mean, I call the thing the acorn theory, that we start with a little nucleus that doesn't ever leave us. And of course, we often go astray and close the door to it and don't hear it, but there's something there.
Right, and I guess also in the astrological language, it's the concept of Venus, that what we have an affinity for is a crucial clue in the spiritual detective novel of our life.
That's good, the detective novel
of
our life.
Yeah, we really want to reverence that. I also thought it was completely interesting that Josephine Baker, and you also talk about Judy Garland, and then somebody you don't talk about, Marilyn Monroe, but all three of them were Geminis.
Yes.
Again, this sort of Venus in America, Gemini fixation. But you contrast very nicely Judy Garland
and Josephine Baker.
And Josephine Baker,
because
right.
Because Judy Garland tried, she was called at 2.5. She was already a star at 2.5. She couldn't get off the stage. The very first time she ever appeared, she sang Jingle Bells up in Minnesota in a small town with her with her sisters. But she fell down, and the end of her life was a horror. Whereas Josephine Baker entered society, she took on 11 adopted children, she fought for the free French, was awarded medals by De Gaulle, she came back to America and took part in the race revolution.
Working civil rights.
That's
yeah,
right. She was really a person who grew slowly down from the heights into the world. And Judy Garland was dragged into it. She never could quite grow down. So it makes a very good contrast between two people who were called from the beginning and followed their calling, but Judy Garland never could finally grow down. The idea of the myth, though, is an old one, that we start in heaven or we start elsewhere. We start in an invisible world, the soul does, and it grows down into this world. That's why it's so hard for small kids. It's hard for them to enter this world.
Well, of course, what you sort of set up in your previous book, we've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's getting worse, and amplify in this book is that wonderful turning of psychology on its head of the child, say, you use, you know, Winston Churchill, who grew up to be the greatest orator in Europe, and as a child was a pathetic, stuttering weenie. And, you know, psychology would say, oh, he overcompensated.
That's right.
And you say, no, he was daunted by his task.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was already there. His destiny was there. His task was there. He had to save the world through speech and writing, through words. So, of course, how could he do it? He mumbled and stumbled when he was little. Or Manoletti the bullfighter, another one, who was terrified when he was a little kid. Because in the imagination he carried in his image, he may not have been conscious of it, but his soul was conscious of the fact that at 30 he would be gored to death by a huge black bull.
Or as you put it also, too, I mean, if part of you as a little child knows that you're going to be facing two-ton bulls in the arena, you are going to cling to your mother's skirts.
Yeah.
You are going to be a little kind of weenie. But what I was also, where I took heart in this, and I think it's heartening to all of us, too, is that the idea that surely those moments of being daunted by our soul's task extend far beyond childhood. I mean, there are these moments at any point where we have, you know, angst.
Yes.
The image that Doris Lessing uses in a lot of her novels, like Shikasta, is that, you know, there are these spirit guides, there are these invisible parts that at moments of decision where orthodoxy would say, take the money, go for this successful route, our guides are going, no, you plan to do this because a crucial part of world goodness depends on this, and we're sort of
besieged. That's very good.
A crucial
part of world good. You have something to do here.
Right.
And therefore, there are risks and challenges. Now, we're living in a society that's all wrapped in security. All we can think of is pension plans, insurance policies, and the whole question that we are really insured from within by something else. Well, it used to be called Providence, Protective Angel. We've lost all of that. We're simply exposed, thrown out into the world, abandoned, victim. We have a terrible psychological philosophy.
Except I think that the complete collapse of all systems, scheduled for February, by the way,
This
coming February. But, I mean, I think that they already are, and we all know that, but I think the revelation of that is sort of described by, you know, many patterns that we'll be diving into after you, alas, have left us on the show to founder for ourselves. But I think that part of the radical energy that's released is that people who have invested in being good, mm-hmm. which means following the orthodox external kind of what I call the reality police. You know, it's like, you know, I've been very good, I didn't do what I wanted, you know, and then it's surprise, no pension. You know, it's like the force of outrage at being had, you know, I think is an enormous thing to be tapped. And I think it's also in that sense of stress is when everything else collapses, it dives us into there's nothing left but magic. There's nothing left but the soul's calling when the external structure falls apart.
And that may not be as magical as we think it is. I mean, I think that it appears already in all kinds of hints and suggestions and moments of falling in love, moments of sudden attraction, moments of symptoms, moments of unexplained phenomena. These things deserve much more attention than the usual path. The pressures on the usual path are enormous, and they're built tremendously of fear, as if we could really build security. And most of what we read in the papers, most of the economics, is all built on future. It's futures, you know, what's going to happen. So you predict and plan for what's going to happen, which we don't know.
And with no sense, of course, of reverence, it's, you know, the Mayans' word for human is one who owes.
Good.
Now, we don't need to be quite so saturnine in terms of bloodletting and whatnot, but I think that's the difference you're also making between Josephine Baker and Judy Garland. Josephine Baker wanted to give her gifts to the world in every way, not just to get the golden ring.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
as she grew older, she grew low down into the world to take part in its social, political questions of justice and care and loving and duty and all those great virtues.
And I think a crucial part of that also that's very pertinent to now is that the important distinction between being unique, which certainly your book is a call for and speaks to that part of all of us, as opposed to being special. Because being unique really invites everyone, it catalyzes everyone to be their unique selves, whereas being special or important is often humorless
celebrities,
New Age celebrity, all that.
Celebrities are simply examples of the potential that people each have, not to be a celebrity, but to be valued.
Right.
To be exceptional.
Right.
It's that quality. Instead of seeing our pathologies first as simply what's wrong, we see our pathologies as callings to the exceptional, making us different.
Right. And there's a great Japanese saying, actually, that says that art is the tracks, not the animal. You know, that it's the visible evidence of somebody's growing down or their true art, and in a sense, it's not the point that you focus on.
Yeah, we do need these figures. You know, let me read one little section from early in the book.
Please.
We use these figures, these extraordinary figures. I mean, there's Minuan in here, Barbara McClintock, the scientist, Canetti, the Nobel winner, who tried to kill his sister when he was a little boy of four. Ingmar Bergman. There are endless numbers of stories of people's childhood.
And all the wonderful ones who do terribly in school. That's important to come back to that. That's very heartening.
Terribly in school.
Yes, right.
We use these figures as they are always used by culture to inspire ordinary lives by displaying their own potentialities. Extraordinary people excite. They guide. They warn. Standing as they do in the corridors of the imagination. Statues of greatness. Personifications of marvel and sorrow. They help us carry what comes to us as it came to them. That's the important thing. We need these figures, not because they made a lot of money or they're celebrities and got a lot of press, but we need our imagination sparked, enlivened.
Yeah, and the great part also when you do the incredibly tasty chapter on people who just do terrible and orthodox things and terrible in school especially, and the wonderful story about Truman Capote, whose mother, you know, couldn't get him at all and really hated him, but he had the mentor, that important thing. And that wonderful point that you quote where the mentor sits down with Truman Capote's mother and she's complaining about him, and she says, "Yes, but Mrs. Capote, all those little boys that you want your son to be so much like who do ordinary things, in years they'll still be doing ordinary things, but Truman will be famous." Very tasty and satisfying.
Very,
it's like
very sweet.
Very sweet.
And the teacher who saw James Baldwin.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a woman from Ohio who had this job in a Harlem public school, and there's this little 10-year-old boy. And she was astounded. They began to talk about Dickens together. And they had a kind of love between them that went on for years. 40 years later, he wrote her a letter, and she wrote him back, and so on and so forth. Maybe not quite 40 years. But the point is that there's an eye that falls in love with the imagination of the other person, and they see each other, and that's what's needed. And your parents can't always see you. It's not their job to see you. It's their job to get the cornflakes on the table, to put a roof over your head, to get some shoes on your feet. But it isn't necessarily that your mother or your father can see you.
Right.
And it's our job, older people, to see younger people.
Yes,
to see their beauty, to see their imagination, and to bless it.
And ideally, of course, that's what the intuitive arts or the astrological arts were always meant to be. I mean, they've been, you know, malpracticed. But I think it's that crucial part that you mentioned about being seen as food nutrient, you know, actually be perceived, you know, by another deeply and profoundly. You know,
you go to the astrologer to have that part of your soul seen.
I think that's what it should be in its highest level.
Which isn't personal. The person doesn't need to know you intimately personally.
Right. Which is why the experience of so many people who have a good astrological reading is, oh, I am who I think I am.
Yes.
What a relief. I really am. My interior life really is real, even though it has never been seen or validated before.
And in the normal psychology world, we've lost that. You see, we try to see people through tests.
Right. Nightmare. Sociological, statistical.
Yeah.
Nightmare.
And diagnostic.
Right.
And you don't see the soul with that.
No. And you flatten the soul with that, yeah.
Or you avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
You avoid it. And the symptoms which then, in other words, what then gets repressed, the soul which is repressed or not seen, has to rebel through symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the book is full of the peculiarities of the people, of all the anecdotes.
Right.
Because that's where the unusual appears.
But I think also in the astrological language, it would say that sort of the alchemy of what does something want to be, and that things grow toxic by being suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ask, you know, here's this, you know, strange, kinky thing. What did it want to be before it grew toxic due to being exiled from the society, from the psyche society, or from the larger society? And I think part of the theme of now is that we want the awakened imagination of everyone to kind of pull off a dreaming a better world into being. And for me, one of the kind of marvels was working with bad delinquent kids using mythology and astrology and magic and so on. And what I found was that they were incredibly mythologically literate, but underfed.
Underfed.
They'd never been talked to about you can actually, have an effect on your life. You can find your powerful daemon. You can find your power animal. And after a little bit of cynicism, what I found was that they were just incredibly skilled. It was intrinsic, and that there's some part of that puzzle that we've exiled those parts of human imagination that we most need.
You know, what is it we're afraid of? What is it that the school system, the politically correct world, the normal bourgeois, non-magical world is so afraid of?
Well, I call it the reality police, which is that there's that part of any group, no matter how hip or not, that would rather die than change. You know, and that it sort of snookers us into complicity in our own self-suppression. It's sort of the illusion of saying, well, after the revolution, we'll have the state, and then that will wither away, of course. And it's like, no. That structures want to maintain themselves and therefore edit out the disruptive.
The structures want to maintain themselves. I would say it's an archetypal force that's always there, a Saturnian force.
Of
wanting to consolidate and keep what is.
Right.
And not yield.
Of course, the language of astrology that says Aquarius, human community, is governed or has an affinity for Saturn, stability, and Uranus, innovation and change. The truly stable community, of course, is the one that invites and welcomes in the unique creativity of the individual, I think, which is really what your book is a kind of argument for.
It is about that, but don't forget, my book also touches the shadow, that there can be a bad seed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an entire chapter on murderers, on Hitler, on Dahmer.
Right.
On the people in the several murderers in England, the greatest serial murderer in the Ukraine. So it does analyze the problem of how do we understand a calling to tremendous destruction.
But I wasn't even clear after actually reading that chapter. I mean, do you think that that was intrinsically fated or it wanted to be something else?
Nothing's all pre-planned.
No fixed future.
There's no fixed future.
Yeah.
That's not pre-planned. There's no map. There's a calling. There's some tremendously powerful, destructive mystery that does appear in some people.
But perhaps also that's one of the definitions, in a sense, of art and ritual, that whatever we ritualize, we need not live out as a melodrama.
Of course.
The cultures that have contained, ritualized aggression in their dances need not, literalize those.
Absolutely. And I do suggest at the end of that chapter that there are ways to work with these things.
And one caller said, interesting, illuminating about Hitler, but didn't explain it. I don't have any more clue to give you, James, than that. Explain Hitler. Gee, they're not asking for much, huh?
You'd have to, I hate to say it, but you'd have really to read as much as I read in order to begin to get a handle on it. I am certainly not going to have the pretension to explain Hitler in a sentence. It's a deep mythical possession, and I give an enormous amount of evidence to show the mythological background that was there very early in his life.
What I also am interested in, too, is this concept of, without shame or blame, of complicity, that we all are, in fact, related. What I liken it to also is, postal workers who go crazy. It's as though there are pressures that are unaddressed in our culture that push down and that erupt through the most sensitive or vulnerable or thinnest membrane, which we could say is psychic, psychotic, very close together, unusual people who are open to possession by mythic archetype, or just people who've just are vulnerable and had a bad day, and they explode, in a sense, for all of us. So that we don't go, ooh, look evil over there, but in a sense are invited to go, how is this, an externalization of a complicity that we're all engaged in, I think, is part of it.
That's the collective unconscious that breaks through,
right.
to use a term. But I agree completely that it is something, a complicity that we're all involved in.
Right.
And at that time in history, it was not only the German people who were involved in, who were complicitous. With Hitler.
That's right, absolutely. But I also want to quote a little bit from your book, too. First, the sort of setup is Nabokov, in his lectures on literature, said that the history of science is the history of exploded, ridiculous theories. And James Hillman adds in his book also, too, the cosmologies of today, big bangs and black holes, antimatter in curved, ever-expanding space going nowhere, leave us in dread and senseless incomprehensibility. Random events, nothing truly necessary. Science's cosmologies say nothing about the soul, and so they say nothing to the soul. I love that part. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's, you know, very much yes, and that it, in that sense of complicity, you know, I mean, you are a part of all of us that is saying this for all of us.
Absolutely, yeah. And what science is telling us now about the new genetic idea, that's why this book is called The Soul's Code, because what we get is the genetic code. And when you go into the genetic code today, it also, no one is necessary. There is no reason for anyone to be here.
And therefore, the amoral tampering and tinkering. I mean,
you can do anything you want with that genetic mm-hmm. code because there's no inherent necessity in anyone's life.
Right.
We are simply victims of a biological progression, beginning who knows when. And so we get rapturous over finding some life on Mars a billion years ago, if then. What the hell difference does it make? Really, what difference? It only matters if that's your theory of what's important.
But if we add the mythological, I mean, I always read the New York Times through the mythological lens and go, oh, culture wants to talk about Mars.
Oh, well, that's
you
fine.
Know, I mean, in that sense, it's like, all right, culture is trying, struggling to talk about Mars,
yes.
Which is now conjunct Venus.
Now
it is conjunct Venus in the sky. The image, actually, the Sabian symbol for Mars right now is the Indian girl introducing her white lover to the tribe. I think it's about this syncretism and mixing, and part of also what where I felt a profound affinity with your book, and certainly what I'm up to as well, is that you're talking about the cosmology of the invisibles and the
yes.
invisible world,
yes.
and in a sense, what I call visionary activism is the kind of alliance with the invisible world of
yes.
evolutionary intelligence, what wants to happen, and this active offering of ourselves to it. Or to those parts of it with which we have an affinity.
But just bringing the word invisibles back into the culture is very difficult. I mean, 30 years ago, I wrote a book called Suicide and the Soul, more than 30 years ago, and it brought the word soul back into the culture. It was, of course, in the culture in the street, soul brother, soul food, soul music, of course. But basically, soul was not in psychology anywhere.
Right.
And soul is now there. The invisibles have to come back the
right.
same way.
And I think it's also where politically active, left-leaning, liberal people, in a sense, we want to address that or redress that, but they gave the whole issue of spirituality completely to the right wing
yes.
for fear of being mocked as silly.
Yes.
You know, the liberal fear of being accused of possibly having a spiritual life, you know, completely blew the whole game.
Or being... being not rational.
You right. See, the terrible accusation.
Secular. I can't go into that. But that's the bankruptcy. That's the bankruptcy
that's right.
of the left.
And what I think also is that the one thing that kind of compassionate social activism has not had is what I call magic, in the sense of magic simply being an experimental opening to the invisible. You know, and saying, all right, what wants to happen? How do we ally ourselves?
But you know, all the you're talking again and again about white bread culture, but the rest of American culture, Santeria.
Yeah, absolutely.
The world of the Caribbean, the world of the African American, the world of the Creole, and so it's rich with all this.
Completely.
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 It has no problem with the invisibles
right.
or being open to the effects of other things.
Absolutely.
It's only this strange, exclusive, narrow-minded white bread culture. So when Hillary Clinton talks to...
Poor woman trying to have a little...
Eleanor Roosevelt
right.
a splendid woman of our century.
And who doesn't talk to Eleanor?
Yeah,
yes,
and right. to who doesn't talk to someone?
Yes.
Or, to someone, a grandfather, a grandmother, someone. There are constant figures in our dreams and passing figures whom we need to help carry our lives.
Right.
She's mocked. But
yeah.
who mocks her, really?
Only, I think, a very, you know, 0.001% of the people controlling the media spigot.
That's right.
I think that the population was like, yeah, right.
Of
and also, and who doesn't suck toes either? You know, I mean,
exactly.
big deal.
Yeah, big deal.
Right. Big deal.
Precisely.
Talk to Eleanor Roosevelt and suck toes all the time. I mean, because in Santeria, with which I have a great respect and affinity, actually, the idea of the Loa are always riding, piggybacking
yes.
on us.
Yes.
And it's also part of my take about here we have this huge cultural syncretism, cross-fertilization, really for the biggest time in 500 years of cultures mixing. And the view, in a sense, is that the Loas, the invisibles of different cultures, want to dance together.
Yes.
500 years ago, they could only piggyback on the back of thugs. And so it was a very crude and warlike, you know.
They want to dance together.
They
That's
want.
Good.
Yes, yeah. They want to dance together. And so, in a sense, it's our task to create art forms and rituals to allow them to dance so that it's acted out on that level rather than, you know, and also this idea of immigration being welcomed as, oh, more gods, more fruitfulness, more color, more flavor.
Well, you know, the whole question of immigration is basic. The immigrant is the most American of all people because he comes here with a dream.
Absolutely.
America is a dream. America is a religion. America is a fantasy. America is a hope. America is an abstraction that people came to from the very beginning and still come
and
for
needs
that.
The replenishment of that
and
you know,
die yeah, to yeah. get here on mm-hmm. rafts, on canoes, you know, on a boat, in all sorts of ways. The most American people are the ones who are the most who are struggling to get here, though the rest of us who've been here for 100 years or longer are no longer really Americans. We're economists. We're consumers. We're not
right.
Americans.
That's
Americans
right.
live a faith, a dream, a hope, a vision.
Right, completely right.
Yeah.
No, there was a great commentary. I forgot who it was out of San Francisco, and he was addressing the issue of immigration and saying, you know, exactly, these people come with a dream. He said, I have a greater affinity with those who still have a dream than with those who have forgotten how to dream.
Yeah,
exactly. That's right. Yeah. So also, in your book where you talk about the Nagual, the different these are spirits that accompany us. And I think part of what's crucial about your book and this idea of its tremendous accessibility, and I suppose you get to actually take all the intellectuals along with you because they you know because you've earned that credit. You're a kind of undercover agent that's been trained to cross bridges and say, okay, intellectuals, you're allowed to talk about spirits
mm-hmm.
now.
Yes.
Yeah. As well as everybody else. You know. So it's a kind of liberation in that sense. So
I've earned my credentials to yeah,
you have
right. It is not in that sense it doesn't belong it's not a new age book, but it presents a vision that we absolutely must have to counter the kind of reductive rationalistic psychology based on the diagnostic statistical manual and things
right.
of that sort,
so
which is ending up drugging the kids of the culture.
Oh, completely.
Drugging the kids of the culture.
Right.
And setting up an enormous drug, favoring an enormous pharmaceutical industry, drugs to which you can't say no.
Well, yes, I mean, there's never been any such thing as a drug-free culture. I mean, there never will be. It's a question of which drugs are allowed,
exactly.
which kind of support the status quo. And also, they're wonderful sort of reading science metaphorically also, too. Well, not even metaphorically in this case, but I guess it was last year or a year and a half ago, scientists discovered that at the center of the universe, they'd found this huge, or the galaxy, cloud of laughing gas. So the whole thing's a joke. And then they found this huge cloud of ethyl alcohol. So we're waiting for the giant spliff somewhere, you know, but there's no such thing as a drug-free universe. But exactly, in the astrological language, Neptune would be, you know, that yearning of the soul, that dream, that vision. And Neptune, we draw like a trident, and it says, well, what happens to a person or a culture when there is no living dream, when the soul is not respected? Then it gets hooked on Neptune's trident, gets addicted to anything to numb the pain of alienation.
Mm-hmm.
Any of those kinds of drugs. But the alchemy would say, you know, let's feed that. I mean, you do not, by suppressing anything, of course, it grows more toxic. So
that's a very basic idea.
Crucial.
We know that you can't keep gas in a container too long. You can't put garbage in a container too long. It explodes. It forms its own gases and so on. And Freud said repression, you know, will out. The repressed returns.
Well, it's the bad fairy not invited to the party.
Yeah. And it's such a deep archetypal truth that repression is not the way.
And yet, our culture, of course, says build more prisons, you know, hide the toxic waste, push it down until it seeps out of the edges, and treat a considerable proportion of our young people as
and
though
also,
they were toxic waste.
Let's move forward. That very sentence, let's put that behind us. George Bush's famous sentence.
Let's put that behind us.
Put that behind us. That is repression.
Right.
We tried to put everything behind us, and we can't.
Mm-hmm.
We can't even put the war between the states. The Civil War continues to return again and again and again.
Right. And it's that idea, if we can shove something into invisibility, being an invisible, illiterate culture, then it doesn't exist.
And we give it over to the invisibles, and they don't want it. There are things we need to deal with in our visible world.
Right. But it's also this interesting concept of sudden, which is a kind of Uranus concept, which is suddenly something happened, or suddenly the bridge collapsed, or suddenly, you know, this broke out. And what it is really something was always there, but invisible, kind of below the horizon, and then suddenly, in quotes, it emerges, but it was always there.
Good.
It was always happening there, you know. And again, so sudden is a complete illusion. I mean, you know, I expect that there will be many sudden events of collapse of infrastructure. You know, but it's there now for anybody who wants to see and begin to address it, and speak to it. But I think also that what's crucial to what we're all up to and what you're up to in your book is that I think Pluto, okay, in Sagittarius, just to throw in some language. Would remind us that we once, as humans, lived in a world of primordial intimacy in which it was understood that everything was telling its story, everything was talking.
Yes.
And that whatever we talked to would talk back.
Yes.
And I think the crucial part also of the kind of subversive magic that you're up to, that we all want to be up to, is that anybody who reads your book, you're talking to parts of them that will not go back to sleep.
And I have had already, and the book is just out, I've already had the people tell me, strangers. One wrote me, one spoke on the phone from Michigan, one from somewhere else. Someone sent me a fax that it absolutely turned their life upside down.
Mm,
now, there's nothing practical in the book. In other words, telling you how to do this and how to do that.
That's turned
their philosophy upside down.
Right.
I want to say, let me read one more thing.
Please.
Because there's so many exceptional lives in this book. It's full of anecdotes of people's stories. We need to emphasize the exceptional in a society that now, owing to a reverse snobism, is enthralled with the ordinary. With the newly knighted, hardworking, taxpaying, moral, and deserving middle class. Think of those as metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
If the society suffers a loss of soul, a loss of daimonic inspiration, of angel and genius, then before starting off in search of them, why not ask what might be driving them away? What's keeping the angel and the genius from entering our lives? Maybe inviting mediocrity in, just doing a passable job as a team player, not upsetting the boat, holding on to family values, joining the Walmart community, staying cool, fearing extremists and ungrounded underground ideas is precisely what drives the invisibles away. Instead of asking, how can I get in touch with them, think how you're already committed to a pattern that doesn't allow them in.
But it's like there's a Haitian saying that says, when the anthropologist arrives, the gods depart.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar idea, this idea of reverence as well.
Yeah.
No, well, it's a party, I think. I mean, part of how I describe also the patterns of what we're moving into is that, you know, everything, every part of ourselves that has not been invited to the mainstream party wants in, and every part of the culture that has not been invited to the mainstream party wants in. And we need this vision that includes the best of all traditions.
We have the vision. It's the melting pot.
Right.
We do have the vision.
Well, I'm not sure. Yes, we do. Absolutely, we do. But what wants to be given maybe more voice or honored or invited in more is this idea. I just remember interview with one of the Islamic mullahs who was very rabid and very deaf to Salman Rushdie and so on. But at the end of the interview, he said, well, actually, here's the deal. If Islam were not so dissed, the blood pressure of all the mullahs would go way down.
Exactly.
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 So again, the inviting of the best of most of all these traditions. There's a wonderful thing in the Quran in which Gabriel's talking to Muhammad and said, you know, we could have had no evil at all if we'd made you all alike. But God would have none of it and insisted that each creature be unique. And so evil is the price of uniqueness in the experiment of coming into accord with uniqueness rather than sameness.
That's very good.
Yeah.
That's a nice one. Where is that?
It's the Quran.
Gabriel
talking to Muhammad.
That's very good.
Talking about we could have had no evil if we're all the same.
Yeah.
But God would have none of it.
And that's the problem with the melting pot. We want to take the chilies out of it and turn it all into corn chowder.
Right. And again, see, the subversive thing, I think, that this is, all of this is great, is that I often underpress myself by walking down the street and going, okay, everyone has a Neptune, everyone has a yearning, a dream, everyone has a Uranus, a unique part. Talk to that, bypass
everyone
their conscious mind.
Everyone has a Pluto.
Everyone has a Pluto.
Yeah.
Yes,
that
absolutely.
Pluto, that there again, if we come in touch with that seed that's so mysterious.
Yes.
Yeah.
And to speak to that and to invite that, and even though Pluto, of course, is expensive wisdom. I was talking to somebody with Pluto very strong in their life, and they said, do you know the Japanese poem that says, "Since my house burned down, I have a much better view of the rising moon." And that's Pluto's gift. Mm-hmm, But yeah, no, everyone has that. But I think the subversive part is, again, when we speak to that and pitch it,
yes,
even invisibly, we just invisibly talk to that part of it. It is hungry, it quickens, it wakes up, and it won't go back to sleep, and it won't let that person go back to sleep.
Exactly.
Which I think also about you lobbing this book. I mean, part of what I say about Uranus and Aquarius is that it is time to lob liberating esoterica into mainstream.
And but you see what happens.
Well, what
simply,
happens?
Well, I mean, Hillary Clinton does one little conversation with imaginary Eleanor Roosevelt,
right,
and she's scoffed.
Right.
Well, of course, that's part of the attack on Hillary Clinton and all. But there's still in this white bread culture a terrible fear.
Yeah.
A terrible, straight-laced, peculiar fear.
Well, let's kick it open.
Good.